Okay, well, welcome Storytelling and Organization members. Today we have the privilege of talking with Pete Griffin, and we're just going to start off by Pete sharing a little bit about himself and his work, and then after that we'll launch into his story and some application of his story and some discussion. So hi, Pete. How's it going?
Well, I'm having the time of my life, as usually goes. Thanks, Tom. I retired from the U.S. Forest Service about 4 years ago, and I started doing a little bit of storytelling based on some of my experiences in a 37-year career that started back in the 70s as a wildlife biologist with the Forest Service. And over the years, I gradually took jobs with a little more responsibility, and jobs that included supervision. And I think it was 1999. I moved to Juneau as the district ranger, which is a line officer in the U.S. Forest Service at the lowest level, but I had responsibility for all the activities on 3.5 million acres of the Tongass National Forest. And those responsibilities covered recreation and wildlife, cultural resources, mining, timber, road construction, and I supervised, anywhere from 30 to 75 people in those responsibilities. But I learned a lot of things along the way. And one of the things I'd been interested in was hearing from others the things that they had learned along the way so that I might not repeat some of their mistakes. And eventually got to the point where I thought, well, actually my career was filled with enough mistakes and enough learning experiences that I could put them all together in a kind of a themed program. One of the stories that I tell on myself is one that occurred most recently, and this is a story that I need to start back about 250 years ago at the end of the Little Ice Age, when the Mendenhall Glacier in the Juneau area was at its southernmost extent in its advance, and 250 years ago it began its retreat, leaving behind a broad, flat valley with little rolling moraines, erratic boulders, large chunks of ice that melted and became kettle holes filled with water. And eventually these kettle holes were stitched together with gravel-bottom streams and ecological succession being what it is. The fireweed seeds blew in, and the willow seeds blew in, the cottonwood seeds blew in, and eventually the area became revegetated. Now, flat land being what it is in southeast Alaska, where the mountains meet the sea, flat land is a very dear commodity. And the Mendenhall Valley that was left behind by the glacier was about 2 miles wide and 8 miles long. And the lower half of the valley, the first 4 miles, became developed with subdivisions. And the northern half of the Mendenhall Valley, which was flat, became a wonderful recreation area for folks. Because it was flat and there were trails and people had a great time recreating. Well, one of the things about ecological succession is eventually salmon found the little gravel bottom streams, and the beavers found the streams, and the bears found the salmon, and we have a whole little ecosystem here. And everything was fine and dandy, but the encroachment of civilization eventually meant that we eliminated hunting and trapping in the Mendenhall Glacier Recreation Area because there are just too many people around. And what happened then was that the beaver population just exploded. And they dammed up all the little creeks, and they plugged all the culverts and flooded the trails, and the culverts would blow out, taking the trail with it, and salmon were blocked from access to their spawning areas. And this was the situation where the brand new forest ranger rode into in 1999, rode into town not on horseback, but in a 1992 Dodge minivan. That was me. I'm a wildlife biologist, and walking into this problem, I knew exactly what to do because I've been trained for years in this stuff. I understood wildlife, I understood habitat, and what we needed was a plan to address the exploding beaver population. So I had my folks do up a plan, and I said, here are the things that we need to look at. We need to look at lethally trapping beavers. We need to look at the possibility of live trapping and transplanting the beavers. And because we're a new age organization, we need to look at beaver birth control. But the thing that we needed to do was make sure that whatever alternative worked its way to the top, it wouldn't cost the Forest Service any money. Because it was costing us $10,000 a year to clean the sticks out of the culverts and lower the beaver dams, and that was just a constant every year. We needed to do this more cheaply. So the folks who worked for me drew up a plan, and they pinpointed the beaver colonies that were the most problem. I think we had 12 beaver colonies. There were three of them that were causing the most trouble. So we targeted them. And lo and behold, the answer they came up with was we needed to trap and remove beavers, lethally trapping, because beavers and beaver fur were a natural resource. And a renewable resource at that wouldn't cost the Forest Service any money. Well, I was pretty tickled. These folks came up with the right answer as far as I was concerned. So we also needed a state permit for this because the area had been closed to hunting and trapping by the state. We needed a permit from the state to conduct this lethal trapping. So we went to the state. But there was a complication. Our brand new governor, Governor Frank Murkowski, had been a senator in Washington, D.C., and one of his things to do as a senator...
Hi, it's Jules. Sorry, I was traveling back home.
No problem. Hi, Jules. Tom here. But Pete is into his story, and he's talking about trying to control the beaver population, which was exploding there in the area by the Mendenhall Strip land after a glacier had receded thousands of years ago. But they had restricted hunting and trapping, and now beavers were a problem. And Pete's in the story about how they addressed that, and he was managing.
Okay.
The people.
Well, thank you. Thank you for even sharing that much, but thank you. Okay.
Oh, so we went to the governor, who had been at one time the chair of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources, Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee, where it seemed like his favorite thing to do was to call the chief of the Forest Service to testify, and then he would spend the whole hearing pounding the desk and berating the Forest Service. The Forest Service chief and the lousy job the Forest Service bureaucrats were doing back in his home state because they weren't offering more timber for sale. Well, Governor Murkowski was newly elected, and he got wind of the fact that we were going for a state permit to remove beaver. And the governor, bless his heart, issued a pardon on Christmas Eve in 2002 in saying that the state would not allow the Forest Service to legally trap these beavers, and in addition that the governor hoped that the Forest Service would treat this family of hardworking beavers in a lot better way than federal agencies have treated some families of loggers in Southeast Alaska. Ouch. So that was quite the deal. So we were forced into live trapping and transplanting beavers. We tried it out at the cost of $1,500 for each beaver that was trapped and transplanted. We were able to do three of them that year. That wasn't going to work. So the next year we went back to the state and the governor and, you know, kind of through the back door and said, okay, governor, you've had your way with us, and everybody got a good chuckle, but, you know, we're spending $10,000 a year on cleaning the brush out and, you know, lowering the beaver dams and cleaning out the culverts so that salmon could get to the spawning areas and the trails wouldn't be flooded. And the governor said no, and continued to do that for 4 years. So we were kind of stuck spending all this money on physically handling the beaver problem in the Menhall Glacier Recreation Area. Well, miracle of miracles, I think it was 2006, the governor came in third in his party's primary for a governor. And as a result, a new governor was elected. You might have heard of her, Sarah Palin. She didn't have any problem with issuing a lethal trapping permit to the Forest Service. And I thought, well, okay, now we're going to implement our beaver management plan. And we put a notice in the paper, and oh my goodness, what an outpouring of emotion! There were folks who were just absolutely upset with the idea that we were going to kill these poor little beavers, these innocent little beavers, and it was a small minority, but they were pretty vocal and very articulate. And I got lots of phone calls and letters and letters to the editor, and I was beside myself. I wasn't sure what to do. So I called a meeting. It's one of the two things a bureaucrat can do when they run into a thorny problem. You can either call a meeting or you can issue a press release, and both kind of give the illusion that you're making progress on a problem. So I met with the folks, the friends of the Menhall Beavers, and we had a half-a-day meeting, and we weren't getting any place until finally toward the end of the meeting, I said, well, I'll tell you what, folks. If you will concede that the Forest Service and I have a responsibility for keeping our hiking trails dry and for keeping the culverts from getting plugged and blowing out the trail system and for keeping the spawning areas open to salmon, I'll concede that killing an animal just because you don't like what it does for a living, I'll concede that that is not a moral thing to do. Then these folks thought for a while, and pretty much consensus was that, yes, they agreed that I had a responsibility for keeping the trails dry and the culverts free-flowing and the spawning areas open to salmon. And I said, what alternative might we have that we could meet both of our objectives, where no beavers are killed, where the trails are kept dry and the culverts free-flowing and the spawning areas open to the salmon? And they said, can you give us a week? And I said, sure. And those folks came back in a week, and they presented a plan. It was going to be a volunteer effort by a group of folks they called the Beaver Patrol. And they would take our list of difficult areas and our map where we had pinpointed the problems with the different colonies, and they would, by hand, pull out the sticks out of the beaver dams and lower those. They would keep the culverts clear, and they would make sure that the spawning areas were open to salmon migration. And I said, I can live with this. Now, if you do this for this next summer, and the trails are dry, the culverts are free-flowing, and the areas are open to spawning for salmon, I said, we'll continue. We won't kill any beaver, and we'll continue this. So every year we'll have a meeting. What are we going to do at the end of the season? What happened? Were the trails dry, the culverts free-flowing, and the salmon getting to the spawning areas? And if we do that, we would continue this agreement. And sure enough, I retired 4 years ago, and it's been an ongoing 6 or 7 year project. Those folks have done the work to keep the trails dry and the culverts open and the spawning areas open, and that has been a terrific agreement. And the things I learned from all this at the end of my career, there are two main things. One, if you run for governor in the state of Alaska, you better not be soft on beavers. The second thing was that sometimes leadership in natural resource management doesn't mean hopping to the right answer as quickly as possible and then just giving it to folks. Sometimes leadership is sitting down with folks who are opposed to what you want to do and saying, is there an alternative where we can both meet our objectives? And that was probably one of the most important things I learned about natural resource management and leadership in natural resource management. And I pass that message on to other folks to this day. Thank you.
Thank you, Pete. Yeah, you can hear our applause for your story there. So many interesting things. Say the first one. I missed the first learning about if you're going to be governor.
If you want to run for governor in the state of Alaska, you cannot be soft on beavers.
Oh. You cannot be soft on beavers. Oh.
I like soft on crime.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great.
So that one is also available. Folks heard me do that at the University of Alaska Southeast. They have a spring forum, and one of their topics was the relationship between society and wild animals. And they had me tell that story in particular, and that is it's an embedded video on my website, thestorytellingranger.com, if folks want to see me performing that story.
Mm. You know, I didn't have that. I should send out that link. So maybe, Pete, just after we talk today, you could send it to me, and then I'll send it out to the membership.
Okay.
Yeah. Any questions that came to mind for people right off the bat here?
You know, Pete, this is Mark. It's interesting because you had almost both ends of the spectrum, right? You had to deal with the political side of the house, which is, you know, got its own little idiosyncrasies. But then you also had to deal with the antithesis, and that is the engaged organization that's either protesting or supporting something, and trying to find a happy medium, but still get your job done. And do it in a way that shows the short-term results as well as, you know, protecting the long-term interest and strategy of the organization, in this case, you know, the access to the environment. And that happens all the time in a business setting, but it's interesting to hear the story told in a way where you can't talk about profits, you can't talk about stockholders, you can't talk about those things. Yet you still have to get the same kind of impact as results. So thank you for sharing that. Interesting story.
Well, that tension between science and society and politics, while frustrating, was one of the things that made the job really, really interesting.
Yeah. Say a little bit more about that.
Well, I handled so many large decisions, whether in permitting a large gold mine, which would employ a couple hundred people, which in a community of 30,000 was a big deal, timber sales that were certainly controversial in Southeast Alaska. And even something as simple as tourism raised the hackles of some folks because of the impacts. And the one, probably the first major controversy I ran into was helicopter tourism, running helicopters and passengers from the cruise ships up to the ice field to land on the glaciers.
Wow.
Really a wonderful experience, but the noise was very annoying for a lot of folks, and in some cases more than annoying. It affected their lives negatively.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the tension of making sure that you follow the laws, and disclosing and discussing the environmental and social impacts of those decisions, acknowledging those impacts rather than just sweeping them under the rug. So that, and of course there's always the court system behind that as well. A number of times we ended up in court on decisions that I made, and that was that was always an interesting factor as well.
Mm-hmm. Hi, Pete. This is Tricia speaking.
Yeah.
And I was just thinking as I was listening to you that there's you must have when you just started talking about the helicopters, I thought, well, there's another whole story right there. I think your work it really is so interesting and so different, certainly from my perspective, living just outside, you know, the city of Boston. You know that it's very exotic to me to hear this, and yet. The theme came across, you know, that sometimes the first solution isn't the best. You have to work your way through. Something creative can happen. And so I'm wondering, who would you tell this to? Because, you know, who would be an audience you would tell this to?
The story that I just told, I have told that to general audiences, but it's a story that I left with the folks that I worked with, folks who are in those in similar positions to me. They're decision makers. They're always looking for the balance in decisions that they have to make, and those are the folks that probably most appreciated that story. Of all that I've told.
Yeah. I was thinking that it could be a story for leaders. It's a story about problem and change and you know, getting beyond positions, you know, coming up with a new solution that would work, you know, in a number of environments, you know, for managers in business or nonprofits or whatever, because it's sort of like, you know, you're constrained on so many fronts, you know, and a lot of it, there's some valid viewpoints from all the constituencies, so how do you work your way through it? So that's just what I was thinking, you know, that
mm-hmm.
could, you know, that's kind of what I heard, you know.
Yeah, very good.
Mm.
Is it one of the, if I cut somebody off, but I was just wondering, Pete, if, and this is Tom again, if this story is one of the stories that's then in the archive of stories from the Forestry Service.
It is not.
Okay. And the reason I brought that up is because that will be part of our pre-conference session, and that will be very interesting to hear a little bit about those stories and how they're acquired and kept and disseminated. But this one is kind of in its own little archive. You passed it on to the people who directly followed you then?
Before I left the agency, for 4 or 5 years, I kept a log of what I called Tongass Leadership Tips, and that was a collection of stories and incidents and advice from the different people that I worked with on the Tongass National Forest over the years, and pieces of advice that they might have for other folks. And most of it was simply advice, lacking the story behind how that advice came to be. My contributions were a little more full-blown, a little more story-oriented. But that, in fact, I just talked to one of the folks I worked with on the forest just a couple of months ago, and apparently that compilation of leadership advice is still being circulated and added to every year. So that was a nice legacy.
Yeah. I also think that it works, as Tricia was saying, in just any field, because there's those same kinds of situations of having to be patient for the right timing, you know, wait out a governor and negotiate with your opponents. And you starting that, you know, just agreeing that they had a good point, and, you know, would they not agree that you had a good point, which it seems like there's so many instances in business that would be applicable to.
Oh, yeah.
This is David. There's definitely a lot of applications in business because as opposed to waiting out a governor, you wait out a bad manager or a good manager, either way. I mean, everything changes all the time, and so you wait that out. I really see part of this applying. I do a lot of work in the financial services field, and underwriters often think there's only one solution to something, and, you know, goodness, if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. Well, as we all know, and as your story well tells, not only are there multiple solutions to issues, but they all have to be weighed, and weighed giving different kind of weight, magnitude toward each one to come up with the correct decision for the correct time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. This is Tricia. I don't want to, if anyone else has a question, I'll defer to them, but if not, I'll go ahead because I've already asked a couple of things. So is anyone waiting to say something?
No, it's Jules. No, I'm good. I'm happy listening.
Okay, well, then I'm going to plow ahead. I have a structural question. I went to something about a month ago with Doug Stevenson. And is it Doug Stevenson or Doug? I think it was Doug Stevenson. And he does story theater, and that's his kind of thing. And he talked a lot about the endings of the stories. And he talked about having not exactly a call to action, but somehow relating it to the audience. So I've been doing that, and I didn't used to, but it would be something like, and you have to be careful that it's not overly obvious, but something like, you know, when you get to the end, you say something, so in your lives, you know, what's a situation you're, that is much too obvious, but what's a situation you're dealing with where this might resonate, and how are you handling it? And I'm just wondering what people think about it, because I think the story's fine without doing that. But I've been reading a bit, and I see a number of people talking about that. So any thoughts on that? Just sort of like, it's like you give your theme, and then you toss it out to the audience.
Mm-hmm.
Like a compelling question to leave us with, like this is Jules, like the question that you can visit any situation or situations like this. This is like our in our toolkit now, things to think about.
Yeah. Yeah.
I thought, in a way, that's partially what Pete did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because he concluded the story, but then he started that kind of wrap up with, so this is what I learned from it. And then the first one was really kind of a joke, but maybe not exactly, of the governor can't be soft on Beaver.
I love that.
And then the other one was the more applicable to most people, you know, that the first quick decision isn't always the right decision, and sometimes it takes quite a while to come up with the right one, and you have to sit down with your opponents. So in a way, I think that this is a story of an example of doing that. Did you think that, Tricia, or were you?
I did. I was just, I'm thinking it's like the lesson learned, which was there, and then, and maybe it was there, but just sort of like, how does this now apply? How do we make it more to the audience, if indeed that's the point?
Well, I am.
I don't know.
You know, Tom coming back here, and Pete, you can jump in here at any moment, but just one thing that I love to do is then open it up to a discussion, either in pairs or trios, small group, and you say, you know, you've just heard this story. Now, how is it applicable to our situation? And then it becomes a generative story in that you generate ideas and lessons from it that are applicable to the organization or the group of people that are there for you. And then people can grapple with that and discuss it.
Yeah.
And then you can open that up and harvest it with what the small groups came up with.
I think that's what I'm thinking. Yeah. that I could see it in addition to the way Pete did it. You know, it could go in another direction. Maybe it's depending on your situation. You know, like are you in
yeah.
that kind of environment where you want, you know, as you say, the harvest thing, the harvesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
okay.
I think those
yeah,
this
no,
is Dave again. I think those things work out good in a workshop kind of form, but
mm-hmm.
I also
yeah.
don't see anything wrong at all with challenging people and saying, you know, when you have your own issues, I challenge you to think about the maddening battle with the beavers on this area in Alaska and the years that it takes to solve that problem and the multiple ways to do it in your own situation.
Mm-hmm. And David, when you're thinking about that, you meant like if you were actually at an organization and you're a manager or you're somebody who's brought in to work with the employees to just kind of pass that tip on? Is that how you mean it?
Yeah, it's the kind of form that I would do. Yeah, typically the types I talk to are the C-worlds, the CFO, CEOs.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes senior managers, those types of things, and
mm-hmm.
Typically, and I've had one boss in my life, and I tell the kind of a quick story of he was the best and the worst manager I ever had. But
mm.
on his best side, what he told me was, you want to take situations that are difficult. If you take over a situation that's easy, and you keep it going easy, you get zip credit. You take over something very difficult and solve it, that's where you get paid, and that's that kind of thing here. So you take over a difficult situation of, you know, you're spending money on beaver remediation and you wanted to save money and fix the rivers better. It took some time and effort to get that done. You get recognized for those types of things.
Yeah.
So that's kind of how I see that play through.
Yeah. Yeah, there's so many levels there. Pete, any more comments on that?
Sometimes I tell that story just for entertainment. Because there are, you know, there's a little bit of natural history in there about glaciers and glaciers receding and ecological succession and the interrelationship of all the resources. And then of course there's the just poking fun at myself, the know-it-all college graduate with a degree in wildlife biology. Being humbled by a very small group of folks who just said no.
I mean, I would think it'd be cute too. You could almost do more of a parable on that, Pete, dealing with a side story on the maddening world of trapping beavers and how whatever you put in there for bait or whatever, and how they would circumvent whatever you were doing, and I like the part where you said, you know, it costs $1,500 to trap every beaver. Well, I imagine
yeah.
I could probably buy a beaver cheaper than $1,500. So, but I think there's a cute little side story you could embellish a little bit more in there too.
Sure.
So that if you're, and a beaver is nothing but an analogy for a problem.
that's all it was. Good point.
So you're trying to trap your problems and capture your problems and solve them, and that's what your beaver was that this your problems that everyone has.
Yeah. Hey, Pete, I know you have at least one CD that's done. Are your CDs available on your website?
Yeah, the one CD that I have out now is available on my website. That's the Skunk Whisperer, and that actually the title track is another one of my learning experiences with the Forest Service, and actually there are a couple of them in there. The Skunk Whisperer and Talks with Wolves are two of my learning experiences from my Forest Service career.
Yeah, and the name of your website again, and just in case somebody's listening to the archive here and doesn't have list to the link I'm going to send out to the group, what's the name of it again?
It's www.thestorytellingranger.com. That's no spaces, all lowercase.
Mm. Okay, the Storytelling Ranger. Well, that's a great story and lots of good information from it. Does anybody else have a question or a comment before we wrap up here?
Jules, not me. I'm pretty happy with the questions that I asked, so thank you.
Same here. This is Mark.
Sharing that. Sorry. I just wanted to thank Pete for sharing that with us today.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Well, thank, and I think it was Dave that mentioned that was a, beavers might be a parable for something. I thought, oh, my goodness, beavers might have been my Beowulf.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's great.
Yeah, Dave, did you say, you know, beavers were just like a
beavers are your problems.
Problem.
We all deal with business issues and problems, and
business
you just happen to have them on 4 feet with a big tail.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Big teeth.
Yeah. I just wanted to ask a quick question, and then thank you, Tom, for letting me just listen in as I, and I'll join this as a subgroup.
Sure.
But I've been working with organizations too on and helping people tell stories really more from a sales and a marketing standpoint also, and I've done it a few times for some organizations.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know whether anyone had some other suggestions because I've just taken out of my. You know, my own experience, my own stories on helping develop people and their ability to tell stories. And didn't know whether anyone had some thoughts on that.
So restate that question or, you know what?
I'm working with marketing firms and helping them develop among their salespeople the ability to tell stories to customers, so as opposed to telling them facts about a product or a service that they can actually relate it to them in a story format, sort of like the old car thing where the guy says, I can see behind this car and the air blowing in your hair and listening to the radio. So doing a picture for someone versus just saying facts about a product or service.
This is
Mark. One of the things that I've done over the years in any of the executive coaching I've done or working with managers and leaders is similar to what you're talking about in helping to coach managers to paint a picture versus share the facts.
Yes.
And you know, many times what's really helpful is to take real life true because, you know, employees and others really want to hear what's true. You know, they don't want to feel like they're being sold something.
Right.
And even with sales folks on the mortgage side or anything, the financial services side, I always talk about, you know, you don't need to tell the group the person's name, but you could talk about the fact of the time when you really helped this person who was going through these challenges and these issues and how they leveraged off the products and services that you had to offer and what you did to help them better, you know, to provide a better impact or a better life, you know, that they're living. So any product or service, you know, if it's really worth its weight, as a value exchange. And the value exchange isn't just, oh, wow, you know, I got three for the price of two. You know, what it is, it's really about, you know, how people use that, what they got out of it by utilizing the product or service, or what the differentiating factor is. How is, you know, where are the stories that model how the organization is living the brand. And an easy way to think through that is, you know, most everybody has had or heard of a Nordstrom story, right? Well, most
right.
Everybody has heard about the time where, you know, when you least expect it, you know, a doctor actually had a bedside manner. What a concept. And how that doctor changed the approach and took away the fear of a procedure or those kinds of things. Since I don't know exactly what it is that your product, service, or features and benefits that are you're looking at, but really it's around going back and sharing with the organization. Here's how we've made people's lives better. And even if it's selling, you know, ready-made pancake batter that just squirt out of a bottle. To make it easier for mom to provide a better breakfast for their kids before they go to school, you know, then that, you know, these are the kinds of stories where you use real life examples. So those were some thoughts.
Okay. Some thoughts.
And it's interesting, Dave, your question, because something that I had just posted as an email comment as we were reminding people of this conversation. One of our members is going to going to be doing a workshop session on storytelling and business pitches to potential investors, which is kind of close. You know, if you're talking about storytelling and marketing and how it can be used in that sense, I think it's a similar track. And one of my hopes is that as we have our website up, we can have different subject areas that we can post resources that would relate to the different content. And this sounds to me, just because you're bringing it up and somebody else brought it up earlier in the week, it's a hot topic. And it's one, you know, that's been around for a long time. You know, marketers, you know, commercials, they try to put in the stories.
No, it's not just I'm here in Pittsburgh, and so we have Carnegie Mellon and Pitt, and I've made presentations at both of their graduate schools talking to their students about how do you tell a story when you're either interviewing or when you're going in front of a board of directors, when you're going in front of, you know, and most people don't think they have any stories to tell and don't have any idea how to tell it. So just helping them get over that initial fear of telling stories even.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Is
in
a
both
big part.
Two of the people who are on the line, Tricia and Jules, are kind of in that business as well.
Okay.
Yeah, one of my thoughts was that when it's particularly around interviewing and people feel I don't have any stories to tell and they also tend to minimize some of their accomplishments or they're too general about them, I suggest that they distance themselves from their current or past job and they write a job description as though, like, they've been given a great promotion. All they have to do before they take on this great new place is to write their job description and hire their replacement. And they really have to hire the best and the brightest, and their reputation is going to depend on this hire, et cetera, et cetera. So I set the stage a little bit. And then they are somehow liberated from, it's not just about me, it's third person. I just have to fill this job. But so what it takes to do the job, the what and the how. And that tends to be kind of a nice trigger for them to get in touch with what they've actually done. And that's the first step then, and then we can build the story from there in terms of an accomplishment.
That's a nice exercise because you're right. People diminish their value.
Yeah.
That's just,
right.
I don't know why. It's
bragging.
Yeah.
It's so far away from bragging, but the fear is great.
I call it puffing. I tell a quick turkey story about in my yard where I have turkeys and there's hens and toms. And the toms throw out their feathers to attract the hens. If they don't throw out the feathers, the hens, they're not interested. And the essence of the story real quickly is no one's going to put your feathers out for you. You got to put your own feathers out and puff.
I'm going to use that with a client tomorrow.
Yeah, you're more than welcome.
And quote you.
Yeah. Oh, wow, nice analogy. All right.
A lot of nature stories on this call.
Yeah.
It's funny. It's great.
Great. Well, let's keep in touch, and if people have ideas for our next Story Lab calls, just email them to me. That would be really great. And in terms of subject area, that would be appreciated as well.
Absolutely.
Wonderful.
So thanks, everybody, for taking part in
this
call. We're going to have a little executive conversation right after this, so those people stay in the line. But thank you, everyone, and thank you to Pete Griffin for sharing such an interesting, entertaining, and thought-provoking story. Thanks, Pete.
And this is Jules. I'll be at the Northeast Conference next week. I am seeing Tricia. We're having breakfast together on Sunday.
Yeah,
and
if
anybody else is up there, please let me know. I'll be running around.
Yeah.
And again, this is Dave. I appreciate you all letting me listen on the conversation, and I'll join the group and hopefully learn from you all.
Yeah.
Okay.
Glad to have you.
Okay.
Thanks.
Cheers.
Welcome. So long, everybody.
Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Turn off the recording now.